Welcome to The Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and today we're going to talk about the TikTok ban floating through Congress, woke AI and the controversies over at Google, whether blue cities are turning their backs on progressive policies, and then the loosening of academic standards all across the country. We'll talk about all that and more with Stephen Kent, who has been on this podcast quite a few times. He is the media director at the Consumer Choice Center, which has been intricately involved in this TikTok debate in Congress. He's also the former host of Rightly, and he is the author of How the Force Can Fix the World, Lessons on Life, Liberty, and Happiness from a Galaxy Far, Far Away. But we're going to have to stay in this galaxy today, Stephen, unfortunately.
You don't want to talk Star Wars, Ravi?
Yeah, I'm not. Well, it's a sore subject nowadays, because what does it mean to talk Star Wars? I feel like there's too much to keep up with.
Is Rey really a Skywalker? You know, should they be on TikTok themselves? Tough questions.
Well, it's great to have you back on here. I've often found myself in the course of the past year or so since I've spoken to you, just thinking about, you know, I wonder what Stephen will think, because, you know, like Liz Wolf or Ricky, you're kind of an idiosyncratic conservative, which we like to have. We like to have these political eclectics from the right on this podcast. And you and your organization, the Consumer Choice Center, you have been in the middle of this debate over TikTok. And just this past week, the House Energy and Commerce Committee passed 50-0 a bill that would effectively ban TikTok. And so maybe you could talk a little bit about what this bill would do, but it's being framed as an essentially a ban.
Well, it is being framed as a ban by the propagandists within TikTok, or I guess we call them PR people. I'm a PR person. That's what we do. But it's their job. They're calling it a ban, a de facto ban on TikTok, if TikTok and its owner, ByteDance, does not find a U.S. entity to own and operate it within the United States. So the divestiture bill would essentially force this sale to happen. And if there is not a buyer or a purchase made within X many days, then yes, TikTok will receive a letter from the House Energy and Commerce Committee ordering that they cease operations within the United States. Goes down something more or less like that. But I mean, this is a huge milestone in this debate, because there has been conversation that has gone on for many years now, at least since the last presidential election, about banning TikTok. And there was some traction for that. Donald Trump even made motions when he was still in office to ban TikTok, but it lost in the courts and got held up there. So this is the first time this has ever actually moved through Congress in a substantive way by making it through a committee and making it through the markup process.
Biden's been interesting here. Biden took over this sort of Trump jurisprudence. As you mentioned, the federal courts smacked down Trump on First Amendment grounds, which they also did on the Montana ban. It seems like the courts, generally speaking, don't like blanket bans for First Amendment reasons, but have seemed to allow targeted bans based on national security. And a lot of states and cities across the country, 30 plus states, tons of cities, have some effective restrictions on the use of TikTok, on whether it's on government technology, et cetera. So it seems like national security is a rationale that has been supported, and that seems to be the route that Congress has been considering here.
Yeah, and so I just want to preface this by saying that this makes me feel icky on a couple of different levels, Ravi, because I am a lifelong market libertarian. I believe very strongly in the ideas of, you know, free consumer-to-consumer activity. I work at the Consumer Choice Center, where that is our guiding principle. However, foreign espionage is not covered by the First Amendment. That is not something that we are particularly acquainted with when it comes to consumer choice here in the United States or benefit. National security is the favorite go-to excuse of Democrats and Republicans for shrinking Americans' freedoms. This is something that I've always believed. I came to understand it at the beginning of the days of the Patriot Act. And so this is the go-to excuse for when you want to expand government. But look, I mean, something clearly came out in this classified briefing that the Energy and Commerce Committee received last week, where after that briefing on cybersecurity threats and espionage related to TikTok, this thing moved very rapidly in a bipartisan fashion to crack down on this app. And reasoning matters a whole lot because, again, Donald Trump, when he tried to do this, he framed it around the kind of speech that is on TikTok, the conduct of speech, blue-haired people running around talking about transing the kids and libs of TikTok and all that stuff. So basically making it about government action on speech. But there is a legitimate worry here, which is not worry, a proven concern here with TikTok that the data that they are collecting and using funnels straight back to the CCP and is used to undermine American national security interests and the interests of consumers here in the US. So reasoning does matter. So First Amendment and speech, not what it's about. This is about the quality of the conduct that TikTok and ByteDance engage in.
Yeah, this has been the sort of squirrely part of this debate is like, what exactly is this company? Where's the data? Who has control over the data? There have been some puzzling moments like the sort of Tom Cotton back and forth between the CEO, which Cotton was asking him about his citizenship, and he was like, I'm from Singapore and all that.
You said today, as you often say, that you live in Singapore. Of what nation are you a citizen?
Singapore.
Are you a citizen of any other nation?
No, Senator.
Have you ever applied for Chinese citizenship?
Senator, I serve my nation in Singapore. I did not.
Do you have a Singaporean passport?
Yes, and I served my military for two and a half years in Singapore.
Do you have any other passports from any other nations?
No, Senator.
Your wife is an American citizen. Your children are American citizens.
That's correct.
Have you ever applied for American citizenship?
No, not yet.
Okay. Have you ever been a member of the Chinese Communist Party?
Senator, I'm Singaporean. No.
Have you ever been associated or affiliated with the Chinese Communist Party?
No, Senator. Again, okay. I'm Singaporean.
Tucked within this, though, is a real debate, though. And I think, as you've mentioned, I bulleted out the concerns here, and we'll link in the show notes. We've done a few podcasts where we kind of outline these in details, but one is access to user data. TikTok has repeatedly denied ever passing American user data to the Chinese government, but their representatives have admitted that the app was used to occasionally censor videos. At a 2022 hearing, TikTok's interim COO, Vanessa Pappas, testified that the app doesn't share data with the Chinese government, but she wouldn't commit to cutting off Chinese employees' access to American data. Let's go to a clip from that hearing.
In response to a letter from some of my colleagues, TikTok claimed earlier this year that the company has never shared data, never, with the Chinese government. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
And has never shared data with the Chinese Communist Party. Is that correct?
We will never share data, period.
My question was in the past tense. Has TikTok ever shared data with the Chinese Communist Party?
We have never shared data with the Chinese government, correct.
With the Chinese Communist Party?
Yes, correct.
Have you ever shared it with two members of the Chinese Communist Party?
We have said many times, Senator, that we do have Chinese engineers based in China. I don't think there's any platform up here that would be able to speak to what you're talking about in, as it relates to the political affiliation of an individual. But I'm happy to assure you that we are ensuring the access controls around our data as well as the storage of that data in the United States.
So I think you're telling me that there are TikTok employees or ByteDance employees who are members of the Chinese Communist Party? Is that to what I
No, I'm saying I wouldn't be able to verify that.
Oh, well, let me just ask you that affirmatively. Are there TikTok employees or ByteDance employees who are members of the Chinese Communist Party?
Senator, I'm saying nobody that's sitting on this panel could tell you a political
I'm not interested about anybody's opinion. I'm asking
individual.
You a factual question. Are there members of the Chinese Communist Party employed by TikTok and ByteDance, yes or no?
I wouldn't be able to tell you the political affiliation of any individual.
So that's Senator Hawley, by
Amazing.
The way. So yeah, tell me, I could see you going one of two ways here. I could see you being like, this is a McCarthyite, yada, yada. Or I could see you being like, all right, this was effective calling out of bullshit.
Oh, that was incredibly brutal for the TikTok CEO in that position. So this was in 2022. And I just want to tie together a couple of threads here. First of all, what we were witnessing there was incredible amounts of wordplay. Data was not shared, okay? Sharing and the act of, you know, something being shared is like, all right, you know, I'm holding out this thing to Party A, and Party A is then taking it. We are sharing, and we're doing it willingly. In 2022, BuzzFeed reported that 80 internal TikTok meetings have all showed that U.S. user data was repeatedly accessed from China. So there you have a different set of rhetoric, that data was accessed from China, as if somehow the data was just in a pot, and then Group A reached out, put their hand in, and took it, and wow, it just ended up in their hands. So that's kind of number one, is they are basically saying, no, we don't like hop on Slack and share the data. It's just merely accessed by people who happen to be in China. And then right there, you also have the TikTok COO using language that Americans might understand. The political affiliation of Chinese employees, there is no political affiliation choice in the communist-run country of China. You are either a CCP member or you're an enemy of the state. So what she is saying, Americans might go, oh yeah, that's so interesting because that's how we think. But that's not true. And I think she knows that.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I see it cutting both ways. And to be clear, I'm sympathetic to this ban. But I also want a standard that we apply to all companies, right? And the last time we talked about this, I talked about like there are companies like the NBA or various Hollywood production studios that to me are as important to the culture of the United States that are explicitly bowing to pressure from China in plain sight. And although it's hard to make that illegal, it certainly seems to be a problem for us. And I'd want some scrutiny across the board of companies that bow to Chinese pressure. But this is a unique company because of the unprecedented amount of data. There's something like 170 million users of TikTok in the United States. And second is that the algorithm itself is a political weapon. And the Chinese government, it has come out in repeated reporting that they've censored videos that talk about protests in Hong Kong, the Tiananmen Square protests, the treatment of Uyghurs, never mind stuff that we're not sure about, which is, you know, affecting debates about Israel-Palestine or American politics. Like, we just really don't know.
That's right.
And that's a problem. And that's part of the reason why there's been some rare bipartisanship here. Mike Gallagher, the Republican representative, and Representative Krishnamurthy, who's a Democrat, came together to craft this legislation. And according to reporting from the Wall Street Journal, they have been working together with Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, who's like a point person when it comes to legal issues on national security, who's been working with them on creating the national security justification for this. And when Biden was asked about whether he would sign this, this is what he said.
Question, do you still support a ban in TikTok? Would you sign that bill?
If they pass it, I'll sign it.
Can I ask you a question, Ravi?
Yeah.
When you have talked about this in the past couple of minutes, you say, you know, I would support, you know, a ban on TikTok. I would support this ban. Do you view this as a de facto ban? Because again, that's TikTok's
maybe it's language
on this. Yeah, because it's divestiture. It's a forced sale, meaning there would be TikTok operating every year into the future for the foreseeable future if they have a U.S. owner.
Maybe I'll sort of clarify the language. The ban is of this company operating TikTok. Now, do I think that this would lead to the end of TikTok? No, because capitalism always wins. And so if they can't operate in the United States, or, you know, there are different versions of it, right? There's a version where all future app downloads are halted, but like existing downloads can't be stopped. There's like one legal theory that says that's true. There's a legal theory that says that the servers are going to be at issue here and there'll be a ban, like the ban on servers will stand. It's like, it all depends on how the courts view this, which is why Lisa Monaco, the Biden administration working together with Congress and the congressional record is really important here, because the courts are going to look to say, what was this justification? Was it on speech grounds or was it on national security grounds? And it's also why the Committee on Foreign Investment, which is essentially when Biden took over this from the Trump administration, it was a little bit puzzling, honestly. And we talked about it at the time that he wasn't more aggressive on this. Obviously, there was a lot happening at this period of time. His hands were tied in many ways by the federal courts. But what he did was kick it to the Committee on Foreign Investment, which can give him cover to do a lot. There hasn't been as much activity there than I would have expected. And honestly, Congress has been slower. But one puzzling aspect here, Stephen, is Donald Trump's reaction to this, because he was so supportive of this for so long. And recently, he seems to be walking it back. Let's go to this clip from CNBC.
You have called TikTok a national security threat. At one point, you said that their, quote, data collection threatens to allow the Chinese Communist Party access to Americans' personal and proprietary information And yet it appears that you've now reversed your view on banning TikTok. Why is that?
So I had it done. And then Congress said, well, they ultimately usually fail. They are extremely political and they're extremely subject to people called lobbyists who happen to be very, very talented, very good, and very rich. I could have banned TikTok. I had it banned just about. I could have gotten it done. But I said, you know what? But I'll leave it up to you. I didn't push them too hard because, you know, let them do their own research and development. And they decided not to do it. But as you know, I was at the point where I could have gotten it done if I wanted to. I sort of said, you guys decide. You make that decision because it's a tough decision to make. Frankly, there are a lot of people on TikTok that love it. There are a lot of young kids on TikTok who will go crazy without it. There are a lot of users. There's, you know, a lot of good and there's a lot of bad with TikTok. But the thing I don't like is that without TikTok, you can make Facebook bigger. And I consider Facebook to be an enemy of the people, along with a lot of the media.
So what Aaron Ross Sorkin was reacting to was a truth that Trump sent out, implying that a ban on TikTok would help Meta, which is unquestionably true if it were banned, right? Mm-hmm. Again, to your point, Stephen, the most likely scenario is that it gets spun off. And there is reporting also in the Wall Street Journal that there has been talks amongst a group of people, which has included Sam Altman, about like putting together a group to purchase this, which, you know, begs a whole bunch of other questions, right? Like, I think one of the things that skeptics ask is, okay, yes, China is a national security threat, but our domestic internet companies are very cozy with dictators, right? Altman did that whole tour where he was trying to raise money for his semiconductor company. Meta, Twitter, Google all have had major, major issues bowing to pressure internationally from foreign governments in restricting speech.
We can hold them to account in a way we'll never be able to hold anyone from TikTok to account. They are American companies, and that's the fundamental difference. And this is something, again, like in the realm of things that makes me feel icky about this entire thing is I don't like the feeling of picking winners and losers in the market. And if you force a divestiture of TikTok, which then results in there being a new owner, or that ends up resulting in a ban of TikTok itself because nobody buys, well, then yeah, the business goes straight to Facebook. There's nothing more in the world that Mark Zuckerberg could possibly want than to have his app be cool again, because it's not. Facebook and Instagram's doing better than Facebook, but they would really like to try and do a copycat of TikTok that is more competitive. But it's pretty shocking to see Donald Trump do this complete 180 on TikTok because he hates the American tech community so much that he would then side with an operation, a psyop from the CCP to change American culture and spy on Americans. And we cannot take this thing lightly. The DOJ's investigation, which was reported on in the New York Times as recently as 6 months ago, showed that the CCP uses TikTok to spy and collect information on American journalists and siphon information from their phones if they have TikTok on it, because the permission structures on phones allow for them automatically, if they have TikTok, to gather all of your location data, your browsing history, again, your keystroke patterns, your biometric identifiers. Y'all, that's your eyes and your thumbprints. You've got to stop, kind of undermining or like thinking small about what data means. They don't really care so much about what phone calls you've been making or, again, like all the photos that you might have. There's so much more valuable information that can be collected on people, and you've got to guard it, which I have to say, Robbie, is why we need federal privacy legislation in the United States that actually protects American consumers, not just from TikTok, but also from Facebook and X and all of these social media companies that collect data willy-nilly and data that people might have no idea is being collected on them. But that is the job of Congress, to make such legislation and to also hold to the fire American tech entrepreneurs who can be more easily swayed and influenced than Chinese officials.
Yeah, and in one, rather unfortunate incident for TikTok is that, you know, they're trying to fight back against this legislation. Yes, they have those lobbyists Trump was talking about, but they also prompted their users to reach out to Congress, which on its face is smart, right? Because they have this incredible amount of users they can leverage for this, which is their right, by the way, like in any context, like have your people talk to Congress about what it is they like about this platform. But it appeared to backfire. This is Representative Krishnamurthy reacting to that call.
TikTok actually sent a message to all of its users requiring them to press a button that would cause them to call their member of Congress before they could scroll through the rest of their content on their phone. Well, guess what? The people that ended up calling into our offices were minor children without the permission of their parents. And some of them called and basically said, "What is a congressman?" We cannot have the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, own and control such an influential social media app.
Kids are able to engage in political activism and speech. Like, I don't have any problem with teachers taking their kids to Congress and like meeting Congress people and then falling on the ground over like environmental issues. So we're already like pretty open to that kind of stuff. However, I've heard conflicting reports about this. So what have you heard? Were you forced to make the call in order to activate the app? Because what I have heard from a couple of people in the tech space was that different users basically were not able to access content or create content until they had done the action.
Oh, really? Okay. That would be terrible, obviously. It's still their right to do that, but it's obviously Krishnamurthy's right to call it out and say that that would be totally inappropriate.
And I think that's why he used the word forced, because... Yeah. You know, I again, was appealed to by some complaints about this, you know, this issue, because, you know, they promote through their app that everybody should call their congressman, and that's civics in action. Everybody has the right to do that. I've worked at nonprofits for years who their entire mode of operation is to send you emails that then have you call and write your congressman. So there's nothing wrong with that. But then it was called propaganda. People were like, oh, this is Chinese propaganda in action. They're making kids do stuff. And I went, well, no, not really. But then there have been accounts that apps were locked and that you had to do the action if you wanted to use the addictive, the highly addictive app that feeds on your dopamine. So it's sinister.
This is probably going to pass tomorrow. We're recording this on Tuesday in the House, and then it's going to go to the Senate. And you know, the Senate is a tough bar to clear, not just in getting a majority, but you have to get 60 plus, and you have to have Schumer call a vote on this, which he hasn't committed to yet. He seems to be warm to the idea, but it's not clear. And then certain very powerful senators like Lindsey Graham and has said he's conflicted about it. And then Rand Paul says he's outright against this ban. And I also think that Trump's, as we saw with the immigration bill, Trump has a tremendous hold on his caucus. And you know, although he's not as forceful on this so far as he was on immigration, I think the immigration lesson, at least to me, is that he can bully his own members into voting against their own ideological interests. And so I'll be really interested to see where this goes in the Senate. And what's true here is the Democrats aren't all aligned on this either. So this will be very tricky. Let's just quickly, given that we're on the subject of social media companies, this is a little bit old hat right now, but I just wanted to get your opinion on this rather puzzling story that came out of Google. We did a whole segment on this on a different podcast, the Citizen Stewart podcast, but the woke AI controversy at Google, essentially there was all this reporting that people have been interacting with what used to be called Bard, which is called Gemini now, which I've had a lot of experience using, and I could kind of give my review on it. But they basically were interacting with this AI that was refusing to give white people, it was producing black Vikings, black founding fathers, refusing to condemn pedophilia, black Nazis. And it basically lectured people who asked for Norman Rockwell paintings. I could go on and on, but essentially what has been reporting is that Google, in response to previous accusations going back years, that they had racially biased algorithms, including an example where Google image searches for gorillas were showing up black people's photos and things like that. Obviously horrible stuff. That they, when they were building their AI, were trying to correct for this and seemed to have inserted into the algorithm a little bit of woke programming into this. There's no other way to put it. And the debate is this just an innocent mistake, or is this a reflection of Google's culture and employees and their ideological spin?
So it is a reflection of their culture. And I think when you say, like, is it like a mistake? Is it, you know, malicious or by design? It's kind of both, because I don't think that every layer of Google wanted Gemini to function this way. I don't think every player in Google foresaw that when they rolled out Gemini that you wouldn't be able to get German white Nazis when you search for World War II imagery. But this is actually part of what they've designed this AI to do. And there's some wonderful reporting that has come from Mike Solana at Pirate Wires, where he has interviewed a lot of people inside Google who are very, very eager to talk about what they've seen in the Slack channels. And what you have to understand about Google's AI is that they are basing their entire algorithm and, you know, the coding behind Gemini around aspirational AI, which is making content and images and generating the world we would like to see. Okay. And so this goes directly in line with DEI principles about diversity, equity, inclusion, and equity in certain areas. And so, for example, about 90% of America's farmers are white. It's just a thing, right? 90% of America's farmers are white. However, if you go by DEI metrics, you would like to see equal representation in the farming world between every single race. I don't know exactly what that exact breakdown would be, but that would mean that the fact that there are 90% of the farmers who are white is a problem that must be corrected for. So if you searched on Gemini for "show me farmers," they will all be black or brown.
Stephen, this is such an interesting example. And again, I think this is ridiculous what Gemini is doing. So I'm not defending what they're doing. I think what somebody would say to the farming example is, well, it's not accidental that more farmers are white than black because of slavery and land ownership and certain land grants that happened even well after slavery and the sort of distribution of wealth that occurred in our country. So who owns land is not an accidental occurrence. Now, what's the solution? There are many questions. One is there anything we could do about that today is a major question, right? Like, there are a lot of sensible people who would acknowledge that reality and say, look, like, any solution to that is going to be far worse than the problem itself, which I think is a really good debate. And then number two is, and I think most sensible people can agree, is that this is not a solution. Like, no matter what you think about that debate, and I'm very sympathetic, especially having spent a lot of time down in Mississippi, where it's very obvious where people's land came from, that there is a problem. I'm just very, very, very not convinced that this is in any way related to that solution, if there is one to be had.
Yeah, I mean, this does feel sort of me to, like, if you had AI that was actually perpetuating, you know, really archaic and horrible racism in its early iterations, and then you're like, oh gosh, we got to fix that. You just, like, crank the dial up in the other direction. Basically, what you get is the erasure of white individuals, and that is just what happened. But what was interesting in the reporting from Pirate Wires was that even in the aftermath of this, the conversations about Sujar Pichai has mostly just been that he is completely weak and feckless on this issue and has not been able to actually participate in reorienting Google towards being a company that designs and builds things that people might want to use. He's been completely limp. And so they've even muted people's ability to respond negatively to how he handled the Gemini response on Slack. You can no longer in Google Slack respond negatively to what happened here, because this was embarrassing for all of them. But it's a reflection of their HR bureaucracy, which has smothered innovation with inside Google. You don't go there to create anymore. Now you just go there to argue about the way that, I don't know, images should be drawn up representing Vikings.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about Pichai. He kind of floats under the radar. And I think people, like, there's been like a changing of the guard in a lot of these companies, and whether it's at Microsoft, Google, et cetera. Obviously, Meta has stayed the same. Zuckerberg, I think, we could talk about him another time, but he's proven himself quite capable of holding on to power and growing that company. They've had a banner a year, and he's withstood all the backlash all this time, and his company has never been in better position than it is right now.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, at least financially, their stock price. And obviously, Microsoft has been having a banner year. And Google, despite all this, like, their stock price went down in response to this, but it's still at record highs. And their dominance in areas like YouTube is basically unchallenged right now. And basically, it seems like the only threats to these companies are antitrust legislation.
That's not true, though. Like, in the innovation space, Google's lifeblood is Google search. And AI has the potential to completely devour the search function of the internet and change the way that we access and find and stumble upon information. And right now, Google has just found themselves knocked on their rear end in the AI race. And so again, they're sitting on a big mountain of cash, good stock price, but they're really in big trouble here right now in terms of getting ahead. So I just kind of reject the idea that they're in a strong position.
Here's my position on this. One is, like, as a believer in the market dynamics, I do think the market tends to think they're still sitting pretty high. And I think part of the reason is they're a little bit more diverse than people give them credit for. For instance, YouTube being the number one place for content in the world is not a small thing. But I think number two is, I actually think, as somebody who's messed around with all these AI tools, number one, OpenAI in this conversation has gotten a free pass. They have a lot of these same issues. Like, when I try to get them to engage on a lot of topics, they just refuse. They're not as blatantly silly and stupid about it, but they do seem to have an ideological bias, which I imagine will be cleared up very quickly in response to these reports, because nobody wants to be in the crosshairs of this again. But number two is
more subtle.
They'll be more subtle. But I do think that Google's, like, capitalism always wins. I think Google, despite Pichai's, like, seeming reported factlessness, which I have no reason to know one way or the other whether it's true or not, the economic incentives are for them to fix this. And my experience using Gemini is that there's actually a lot of promise in the tool itself. It's a fairly powerful tool for certain things. I won't go into it now because we probably don't have time in terms of my personal feelings about, like, what I use that for versus other things. But it does have certain strengths to it, that when you combine it with the fact that the enormous trove of data that Google has access to, they still seem to be in a position to weather this particular controversy and succeed in the AI space. So I wouldn't say that their moat is completely, you know, I don't know what the sort of metaphor is. I don't know a lot about moat science, or their moat has been filled in, or
you're
whatever.
Not a moatographer.
Yeah, I'm not a moatographer.
You're,
I just think their moat is pretty solid.
It's a political commentary.
I know. I think their moat is pretty solid, that's my theory. One big thing I wanted to ask you about is, last Tuesday, this got some reporting, but I think given everything that's going on, Trump wrapping up the nomination and all that, this didn't get enough attention. But across the country, there were blue cities continuing a recent trend of rebuking prior progressive policies. So on Tuesday, a series of ballot measures passed in San Francisco. One was mandated drug screening for recipients of public benefits, and the other was an expansion to police surveillance tools and reduced oversight of the police force. The Washington City Council also passed a crime package on Tuesday that will keep people in jail longer awaiting trial. In New York on Wednesday, Governor Hochul ordered hundreds of National Guard troops to deploy inside the subway system. This follows Eric Adams making similar moves to crack down on crime inside the transit system. And I can keep going on and on. The LA district attorney is embattled and had a very, very limp performance in the primary that happened that week. And San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan has, you know, along with London Breed, have endorsed a statewide referendum intended for November that's backed by prosecutors that would increase penalties for drug and property crimes and would roll back a 2014 sentencing initiative that people say was too lax. So, and we can go on. Oakland, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with this. Their DA is under fire as well. You know, I look at this and say, all right, this is good. This is people learning, and we don't have a time machine, but the right time, there's never a wrong time to do the right thing, I guess is the point.
No, that's right. And there's a the dark side Stephen in me wants to gloat and go, you know, I'm glad you've been smacked with reality here, but people have died. There's been just blood and carnage in American cities that are normally beautiful places that anyone would want to go, places of art and culture and vibrant downtown life are scary. They are not places that you want to go. Asheville, North Carolina, one of my favorite places in the world, is one such place. And we were just talking about it in my car the other day with my daughter. Like, it's a place where we would all like to go, but it's a miniature San Francisco. We're not going to go to this city, which has sort of embraced the policies of lawlessness and people sleeping on every bit of public property that they can find. It all makes me so sad. And it's because I got my start in politics in the criminal justice reform movement, the First Step Act and sentencing reform and fighting the prison industrial complex was my animating issue that got me out of working in a Hilton hotel and management and into politics. And we have gone so, so far from trying to create a more just system where people get second chances at having a life and just gone, we will not enforce law at all. And I think that the prime visualization of that, Ravi, is not even Skid Row and the tent cities and just the horrible trash and filth that you see overtaking LA and Washington, DC, but like the militarized subway of Kathy Hochul and soldiers in the subway system. You know, when you embrace policies of anarchy and lawlessness, that is where you get fascistic outcomes and aesthetics and response. You don't have soldiers in subways when you have proper law enforcement and standards on your people. And so people, for all their fears of, you know, a fascist militaristic state, we all know basic political science 101, that is always a response to disorder. And so you have to have ordered liberty. You have to have liberty with limits. And we've lost sight of that in a big way.
Yeah, I was actually, it's funny you should mention Asheville. I was in Asheville for part of the June 2020 unrest around the country and protests. And what I saw there, which I also saw in New York City, were people who had to board up their businesses. You know, these are mostly small business owners who would then spray paint like Black Lives Matter slogans as a sort of sign of just like, basically capitulation. Like,
it's
it's
the Passover blood. You don't want the angel of death to visit your house.
It's like, I'm not sure how many people believed or really one way or the other Black Lives Matter, but they knew they had to signal the right thing in order to stay alive. And look, there are good reasons to be for Black Lives Matter. There are really valid criticism of Black Lives Matter. But the visual of this sort of duress within the city and the intimidation was one that I also saw when I came back to New York City and had some spirited debates with my progressive friends who participated in these, like many, you know, a lot of peaceful protests. And then a lot of them were breaking into like Bangladeshi jewelers in the name of protest and H&M stores. And I'm like, yeah, that has nothing to do with
reform. Liars.
And then a lot of these people also weren't around later on for these initiatives. Like, this is one thing that frustrates me. Is I started an initiative after 2020 that helped people coming out of the prison system train and get jobs in digital media.
That's great.
So many of the people I know who were involved in these protests, they just moved on to another issue. They're the kind of people when October 7th happens, they're showing up to the next pro-Palestinian protest and they're not even at those protests now as Gaza rages on, right? Like, it's just like this short-term activism. And for me, some of the biggest enemies of liberty, I'm on record talking about like my issues with the right, but some of the biggest enemies of liberalism are extreme progressives, because lost in all of this was, as you said, a real conversation we need to have about the incarceration rate in this country, the fact that we send people to prison and can't even guarantee their safety, that things like prison rape are just jokes that we accept in society, that we accept that we can't even keep our own people safe in prison. And we've been locking up nonviolent offenders at historic levels for decades. And there's all sorts of stuff we can and should be doing in those areas, and we should be experimenting. And yes, I do believe in there's a certain messiness to that experimentation. But what people like Chase Subradeen have done, and some of the progressive activists in New York City, is that they basically threw the kitchen sink at this issue and didn't want to focus on the unsexy details of What does it mean to implement that? What does it mean to bring the public along? What does it mean to do trial and error and to pull back as we learn information? And what now happens is, as you said, basically we're going to undo all of that and we're going to be right back to 1990s era criminal justice policies.
And I think this is what's so frustrating to me about the entire thing, because you mentioned this actually with Google, and this was something I had wanted to add to that, which was capitalism always wins. Well, you know, that just is assuming that the people on the boards of major companies and in the leadership structures of those companies are not arsonists, that they are not actually highly ideological, motivated, and capable. I don't want to just throw around the term Marxist, but like neo-Marxists of some kind, who at least have been inculcated in those ideas in ways that they may be aware of or unaware of. And Chesa Boudin is one such person. He is a committed believer in those ideas. And so when you get those people into institutions of power, you will see the fruits of that belief system. And that belief system requires burning down what we know as the American way of life.
Right.
So I don't believe that capitalism will always win. And I don't believe that order will always reign in cities if you keep bringing and elevating arsonists who don't believe in it.
And we'll link in the show notes. One thing I do want to make sure of is that we put everything in perspective. And I'll put this article in there. I think it's from the Times that kind of goes through crime data from the past few years. And we've done a few segments on this, both as crime went up and also as it stabilized. And I'll quote from this article. The number of murders in U.S. cities fell last year by more than 12%, which would be the biggest national decline on record. That the spike that started in 2020 now looks more like a blip, and the murder rate is lower than it was during the 70s, 80s, and 90s. The recent data also suggests that the violent crime rate in 2023 was near its lowest level in more than 50 years. And so I'll quote that, and we'll also put in the show notes this newsletter from Jeff Asher, who's a crime analyst who goes through the data in detail. And so in the sort of coddling the American mind sort of framework, we don't want to panic, right? We want to be measured on this kind of stuff. And I think depending on where you live, crime could have had a significant increase or a decrease. And I think it's a complicated picture. One thing that's unquestionably true is that things happened in 2020 that created unsafe conditions in a lot of places, and that the apparatus is in full backlash mode against a lot of those moves. And that's part of the reason why these numbers are stabilizing, I would imagine.
Yeah. And I one thing that I always hate in statistics and public policy is when politicians will use the historic decline or historic spike kind of stuff to justify big policy changes, radical ideas. There was one instance where this San Francisco House member, you know, California's House, was working on a bill, and still is, that would force speed governors into every car in the state of California. You might be familiar with this. And it was done because of the historic spike in traffic deaths in California. But that spike is because people were no longer under lockdown.
Yeah.
So the spike represents people going back outside. And so the spike is a return to normal.
Yeah.
You know,
but I think in this case, though, and people can make up their own mind in looking at the data, my sense is that the 2020 debate was interesting because it was, depending on where you sort of drew your comparisons, it was the highest point in that recent memory. But it was way lower than it was in the 90s and all that. And people like Ricky would say justifiably, I didn't live in the 90s, so it doesn't matter. And we're not living there now, and we want to see progress.
I agree with that.
I get it. I get it. But also at the same time, and I think you probably agree with me on this, you can get to zero crime, right? You can get to zero crime by locking everybody up.
Correct.
Right? And in New York City, we had stop and frisk, which I think is indefensible the way it was implemented. We were stopping black kids on the street for merely being black. And I think conservatives, liberals, everybody should agree that that's just effing wrong.
Zero can never be the goal.
Yeah.
Zero is not the goal. It's like this with net emissions, right? Like if you want zero, zero right. emissions as the idea of good, you don't want people. And zero crime, it's not possible. You have to have numbers that people can live with. And that whole idea, though, about like cracking down and response, this is where we could get into real danger, because of the historic spike in crime, people are now afraid. I'm afraid. I don't want to take my daughter into downtown DC unless I have to. And so the role of government is to do things that make people feel like they can actually go back outside and feel safe, which is, of course, how we got, you know, the horrible TSA, right? And the TSA is never going to go away.
Yeah.
And so we have to be careful with these instincts, but there does have to be a recognition of the fact that people are scared, and you're going to have to make people unafraid to go outside again. That's going to involve cleaning up the streets, enforcing law, cleaning up tent cities, and reclaiming public property for the public. And I don't want to like lob bombs at the homeless in this country because there are no homes. There's not there's nowhere to live.
I mean, New York
live.
Is a good example. Not only do we not have shelters in New York, enough shelter space in New York, which is something we've covered before, but we don't even have public bathrooms.
Yeah.
So people get mad at a homeless person for peeing on the street or whatever, but there literally is no place to go mm-hmm. for people. And we need to have answers to these questions because we have a constitution. So we can't just lock people up for being homeless. We need to come up with solutions to this. We should just care about the well-being of the people around us.
Deeply.
And we should continue the fight to find solutions. And one worry I have about this is in the backlash, I think we're going to lose our humanity. And I agree with common sense. I deeply believe that people shouldn't have to call the security guard at Duane Reade to unlock the deodorant, right? I truly believe that that's not a just society, right? I believe that business owners should be able to operate their businesses without, you know, social justice protesters breaking in and stealing jewelry in the window, right? In the name of social justice. I believe all of these things. I also believe people should walk down the street and be safe and feel safe and all that. But I also know that life is messy and that like people, you know, become drug addicts or they suffer with mental illness. And these all actually, they prompt really difficult civil liberties discussions. Like New York is a good example where there's like this sort of preemptive incarceration that happens for people who display mental illness, but who haven't committed violent crimes against anybody. And that is an area that I think libertarians, I've given Ricky a hard time about this. I think it's an area where libertarians need to be careful because you have a right to shout on the street, in my opinion, right? You have a right to present in a way that's unstable. You do not have a right to threaten people. You don't have a right to get up in people's personal space. But we need to draw these lines very carefully.
And that's the part about, you know, where it's messy is that y'all mentally ill individuals and people who begin bouts of mental illness, who, you know, lose their job and end up out on the streets, they're going through a thing. And this is reality. People will be hurt who shouldn't be hurt in this world. You're going to have a person who develops schizophrenia or bipolar type 2 and loses it out on the street and hurts somebody. And it's going to be a tragedy. But tragedy cannot be prevented in this life. What matters is how we respond to it and how we either help or punish the offenders and take care of the victims. That's what a just society looks like. Not one where you are guaranteed to never be harmed by another human being. I actually don't want to live in that world at all. I think right. That sounds really dystopic.
Can't have Minority Report, you know?
No, it's not reality.
I get it. If one of my relatives were attacked by a mentally ill person, I understand the reasons why somebody would be like, now let's like go like over, mm-hmm. like let's incarcerate people who present that on the street. And it's like, we just have to be careful. That constitution is the constitution for a reason. It not only is binding, but it also is binding for really good reason. Well, okay, Stephen, we could talk about that issue forever. I do not want to lose sight of the kids. One last set of topics I wanted to ask you about is Americans' falling standards. The Economist had an absolutely amazing article, which basically looked at the historic great inflation, if you will, and graduation rates. And I'll quote from this. It basically found that graduation rates are increasing while academic standards are decreasing, and those two things are related. They said between 2007 and 2020, the average graduation rate of public high schools in America leapt from 74% to 87%. During this period, pupils notched up gains in course credits and grade point averages, so all the subjective measures within schools. Yet, scores fell in objective external assessments, most notably the Program for International Student Assessment, which is the big international test that 15-year-olds take and where we compare students against others. It shows that math and literacy rates are either flat or down during this period of time. And The Economist had this really extensive analysis of graduation rates and standardized test scores from 3,000 high schools across six states, Colorado, Georgia, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, and North Carolina from 2007 to 2022. And it just found this discrepancy. We're lowering standards and students are performing worse. Yet they're graduating.
I don't even know what to say besides, like, I'm not surprised. Like, this sort of feels endemic to what we see everywhere. It's the seeds, or not the seeds, it's the fruit being born of the seeds of the participation trophy idea, which is that we don't reward in our culture right now succeeding and pushing through struggle. We just want to go for outcomes. It's sort of the core rot of the entire equity idea. The idea of equity, we've probably like beat this dead horse a million times on this podcast, but like the idea requires that you force people like through graduation to graduate. Like if you've got a lower amount of Spanish speaking first kids who are not graduating, equity requires you either force other students not to graduate or force those people through the system, even though they may not be ready. And so this is what I am most scared of in our culture, is that we just are not actually asking people to perform to a standard. And that applies in education. And then it bleeds over into the criminal justice world as well. We don't expect people to do things in the classroom. So we don't expect them to behave certain ways on the streets. I think those are intimately connected.
Well, here's what Morgan Polakoff said. He's the USC professor. He said about this equity question. He said, the push for educational equity, and in particular racial equity, has been used in a lot of places to push against higher standards of high school graduation. And The Economist went on to say, when New Jersey debated new testing benchmarks last year, one board member argued that the higher standards would be unfair to Black and Latino students in urban districts. Oregon's decision to drop its graduation exam in November was based in part on a report by the education department, which concluded that the test produced inequitable outcomes or historically marginalized groups. Now, what's interesting is The Economist went on to talk about how lowering standards actually exacerbates achievement gaps, because what winds up happening is the floor gets lower, but the ceiling stays high, because all of the different forces that keep the high performers high performing continue to go on in a world where the standard is lower. But it's actually the standards that help the people towards the bottom of the income distribution and resource distribution the most, because it creates a sense of urgency within our schools to help those folks.
High performers will always high perform. Type A people who cry when they get a B or a C, which my sister is one of those people, you don't have to do anything to motivate those individuals. But she is an outlier, as are the kinds of people who are topping AP classes and honors courses. And, you know, just the other week, I received an email from one of our school board members here in Manassas City in Northern Virginia, alerting everyone in the Manassas City School District that advanced placement courses at the only high school in the city are being scrapped because they are looking at this right now on the school board as an issue of resources and whether or not people should just be moved up into the honors courses who didn't actually perform well enough to belong there, and that AP courses are privileging a very small few at the expense of everybody else, which is complete rubbish.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think there's a bigger debate about pre-K, elementary school, gifted and talented programs like we have in New York, which are just a mechanism for people who claim to be proud public
very
school
strange,
parents.
Very strange.
Yeah, it's
pre-K,
not right.
Talented
no, it's
program.
Not. And needless to say, it's not universal testing and all that. But I think like more gifted, talented, elite AP type courses the older kids get are totally appropriate. And it's hard to even argue with that. One thing that's interesting is this sort of the people who see things differently, including this gentleman named Thomas D, a professor at Stanford University, said the following, pushing back against this data. He said, if more and more students are sitting for these tests, the composition changes over time in ways that probably bias scores downward. So he's basically saying that the reason why the scores are going down is because more people are sitting for the test. The problem is, as the Economist pointed out, he's not right. Actually, the share of students taking the ACT or SAT actually fell from 78% in 2007 to 68% in 2022. So actually more kids are taking the ACT. So it's the opposite of what he said. Now, related to this, the University of Texas yesterday made a really interesting announcement. They had been testing optional through the period of the pandemic, as many schools were, and now they're going back to required testing. And they released data showing that within the University of Texas, the students who provided SATs, ACTs performed much better the year that they enrolled in the University of Texas. So this is what they said. The higher standardized scores translated on average to better collegiate academic performance. Of the 9,217 first-year students enrolled in 2023, those who opted in to provide a standardized test score had an average GPA of 0.86 grade points higher during their first fall semester, controlling for a wide range of factors, including high school rank and GPA. Those same students were estimated to be 55% less likely to have a first semester college GPA of less than 2.0. So turns out, actually, the ACT, SAT predicts your success.
And Dartmouth finally caught on to this. And Dartmouth in February became the first major university to backtrack on their, you know, post-George Floyd commitments to get rid of SAT considerations in college for acceptance. And as a meta point, to kind of tie together a lot of what we've talked about, something that I just cannot shake, it's a viewpoint I've not articulated anywhere. I haven't written any articles about it because I'm not quite sure how to say it elegantly enough, but I will try here today, which is that it shocks me that after George Floyd is killed, murdered, strangled, whatever you believe about George Floyd's death in 2020 under the knee of Derek Chauvin, that we have this flare-up of care about interactions between Black Americans and police officers. And then immediately, within 6 months, the entire tone of the country shifts towards the concerns of bourgeois whites. Whether it is drugs, drug liberalization, and being able to, you know, shoot up on sidewalks, whether it is transgender ideology, which is very much a niche, largely white American issue, and a highly educated issue as well, all the way down to these weird education standards where school bureaucrats and administrators are acting as if Black and Latino kids cannot score the same as white students on tests. We just went so far because of this one incident that happened in 2020 from watching out for the interests of people in America who have so little and are actually on the margins of society for the weird niche political projects of highly educated liberal whites. I just am stunned at how we got here.
One thing I'll mention here is it's not just about admitting students based on their standardized testing scores. As UT in their press release pointed out, their program, actually the existence of standardized testing scores allowed them to have a reliable metric to devote resources to kids who needed the most support coming in. So basically what they're saying is GPA scores and all this kind of stuff are just phony with the grade inflation. So they can't tell based on this qualitative data that's being provided, which I would put GPA at this point with grade inflation as essentially a qualitative metric, high school GPA, and letters of rec and all this kind of stuff. They can't figure out who needs support coming in. But with the SAT, ACT, they had this this program that got a lot of attention and accolades that essentially targets support to the students who need it the most. You and I will have another debate another time on the trans stuff, because I think we haven't had an old-fashioned debate on that one in a while. So I think we'll have to make that part of the agenda.
Premium subscriber only.
Yeah, no, we don't do that.
Steven shout.
We don't do that. We don't do that here. Okay, well, thank you so much. People who are listening, remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Remember, we don't charge you anything. We don't even waste your time with ads at the moment here. So leaving a great review for us, both a 5-star review, but then explaining what you love about the show really matters to us. And remember to send in your voicemail, 321-200-0570. Thank you very much, everybody. And we'll be back later this week.